From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mirta Ojito was one of the 125,000 Cubans who came to the U.S. in the Mariel boatlift. Now on the 25th anniversary of the boatlift, Ojito has written a memoir about the Cuban exodus. Although she came to South Florida at the age of 16 speaking no English, she learned the language, became a reporter for the New York Times, and shared a Pulitzer Prize for her contribution to a Time series on how race is lived in America. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with her about the boatlift. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Never Let Me Go, the new novel by Kazuo Ishiguro, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bruce Springsteen's new CD, Devils and Dust. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On May 7th, 1980, the police knocked on Mirta Ojito's door in Havana and told her mother that the family was cleared to leave Cuba. At the age of 16, Ojito became one of the 125,000 people who emigrated to South Florida in the Mariel boat lift. Castro allowed these Cubans to leave from the port of Mariel on boats run by relatives already living in the States. Although Ojito came here speaking no English, she eventually became a journalist. She shared a Pulitzer Prize for her contribution to the New York Times series, How Race is Lived in America. Now, on the 25th anniversary of the boat lift, she's written a memoir called Finding Mañana. Mañana is the name of the boat that took her to the U.S. Many Cubans were desperate to leave. Thousands had been seeking asylum at foreign embassies in Havana. Ojito says that one of the events that set the stage for the boat lift was Castro's decision to allow thousands of Cuban exiles to visit relatives in Cuba in 1979.
In 1979, more than 110,000 Cubans from the United States went back to the island, mostly carrying gifts and wonderful stories about what life was like in the United States. Created a crisis for the Cuban government in Cuba. People basically were saying, well, we have been told that life in the United States for immigrants is pretty horrible. That's not what I'm getting from my uncle, my cousins, my aunt, everybody who went back. It's not as bad as I have been told. In fact, it's pretty good. They get to have a house, a car in the garage, vacation in Disney World, and people wanted to do that too. So there was a degree of desperation among us Cubans on the island, trying to get out, trying to get to have what others have. And it wasn't just material goods. It was also the idea, of course, of freedom. And that led to several break-ins in embassies. And the most successful, of course, was the one in the Peruvian embassy, April 1st.
Where people were breaking in to declare, to be in a place of sanctuary, to declare that they wanted to leave the country.
Yes, they wanted political asylum. Absolutely. And it happened in several embassies, Latin American embassies in Havana. It just so happened that the six people who went on April 1st were lucky enough to encounter a diplomat, a very young diplomat, who was also a lawyer. His name was Ernesto Pinto Basurco. His name is, he still lives in Lima, Peru. And he very much stood by them and refused to turn them over to the Cuban government. Cuban government, specifically Fidel Castro, got extremely angry, and they removed all the guards, all the protection from the embassy. And it stood there, tempting and open, and in less than 36 hours, more than 10,000 people went into and also asked for political asylum. And the foreign minister of Lima, Peru, began to ask for help to the international community. Several countries said, I'll take 300, I'll take 500, I'll take 600, whatever number. And that eventually led to the opening of the port of Mariel.
When you became one of the people leaving Cuba from the port of Mariel, were there certain things you had to do to qualify to be one of those people that Castro was going to let out?
Well, the reason we got out was because my uncle, my father's older brother, went to Cuba to pick us up. He chartered a boat in the Miami River and basically went to Cuba and said, this is the list, this is the family members I want, and he waited for us. That was one of the ways in which we could leave Cuba in 1980. There were other ways, and the other ways were basically when the government wanted to get rid of you. But one of the categories was family claiming you. And that's what happened to us.
So you had family come to claim you, and that was your ticket out.
That was my ticket out, absolutely. There was my uncle, I did not know it, but I found out during the reporting of the book, my uncle had made a promise to my father to get him out in any way he could and as soon as possible. And that was the very first instance he was able to deliver on that promise. So he left his job. He was an accountant for General Electric at the time, his family, and without even knowing how to swim, which I always find amazing, he didn't know anything about boats, chartered this boat and went to get us out of Cuba.
Your book opens with the police knocking on your family's door.
Yeah.
What did the police say? What were they doing there?
The police were sent to take us to a series, the first of a series of places before we actually got to the harbor. And they first asked for our names, all of our names, asked if we lived there. And we said yes. It was just that day, it was just my mother and me. I was getting ready to go to school. I was in 11th grade. My sister was in a school, and my father had just left for work after a lunch break. And they asked if we were ready to abandon the country, which was a word they used all the time. It was the preferred word, the abandonment of the country, not just simply leaving. And it was loaded with all kinds of political and social implications. So I resented it immediately. But yes, at that point, I was ready to leave.
So the police came to ask you if you were ready to leave because you had already applied to do that?
No, because they knew that there was someone at the port waiting for us, and they simply said, there's somebody out there, do you want to go or not?
Right.
And by us saying yes, it meant they could take us there in a police car.
Why did your parents want to leave so badly? I mean, for as long as you were alive, they had wanted to leave Cuba.
Yeah, even before I was born. My parents were, my father was a truck driver and my mother was a homemaker. And they always, specifically my father, they just never believed in the promise of a better society delivered by Fidel and his people. They just never believed in it. My father was a lot, was very, very much believed in the individual and in what you could do as an individual. He had his dreams. They were modest, but he had his dreams before the revolution, and he could not fulfill them. He had to. That's how he became a truck driver, in fact. He wanted to do something else. But they simply said, this is the job the revolution needs you to do right now, and that's what he had to do. So the whole thing, he also had relatives in the United States, and he really wanted to join them. And he did not understand a system that attempts to rob you of the soul. I mean, this whole idea of controlling who you talk to, who you communicate with in the United States, what you read, what you teach your children, whether or not they can go to church. That did not make any sense for him. And he was constantly teaching me and my sister, but especially me, I was the oldest, that there was another way.
On the day when your family set out to go to the Mariel Harbor and leave for the U.S., would you describe what it was like in the streets? You know, in your book, you described that there were gangs prowling the street because, you know, the people who were leaving were abandoning the country. You weren't being good guys and leaving. There was a very negative association with that.
Oh, my gosh, it was the worst time. I have never seen anything like that in Cuba or elsewhere for that matter. And I think it was perhaps a very dangerous time for the Cuban Revolution because I don't think they even realized how out of hand it almost got. It was almost, I don't want to say like a civil war, but it was very, very ugly time to be a Cuban in Cuba. In my particular case, nothing happened. We were lucky enough that because our neighbors had always known us, they knew that we were ready to leave at any time and that we had never lied to them. They also liked my parents, who were good neighbors. They, in fact, came to say goodbye and asked us to write to them and good luck and all kinds of things. But I know of many stories and have seen many videos in which I know a person who was locked in his house for 47 days. He couldn't get out. They would have killed him. It was a horrible thing. People were throwing eggs, tomatoes, screaming, yelling horrible names, writing on the walls, insults. Just because we wanted to leave the country. And you know, the worst part is, or perhaps the best part, depending how you look at it, that I am certain that many of the people who did that in 1980 are now walking the streets of Miami. They've come from Cuba later. I am certain they are here. Many of them.
I think one of the things that added to like the negative connotations of you and the others leaving Cuba was that in addition to letting people out who had family members in the United States, family members who had come to get them. Castro was letting out a lot of, quote, social misfits, prisoners, people
yes.
from mental institutions.
Yes.
What was his strategy in doing that? What was that about?
Well, imagine you are the leader of a country and in 5 months, more than 125,000 people leave you. It was a public relations fiasco. He had to turn it around, and he's very good at that. He knows how to do that. In addition, he wanted to punish the United States. You may recall that on May 5th of 1980, President Carter urged Americans to receive those of us coming in the boatlift with open arms and an open heart. That cost him a great price because the Cuban government did not appreciate that. And I think it was around then that he began inserting in the boatlift these social misfits and these people who, basically people he wanted to get rid of. They didn't have to be bad people necessarily. They simply needed to be malcontents, people who were not happy with the revolution. It was a great opportunity for him not to have to worry or have to feed people who did not agree with him, who did not want to be there to begin with. And in addition, if we also could get rid of some criminals, perfect. It was like a sweet deal for him. And he knew that they would have been, and in fact, it was very difficult for the United States to detect those people. So he won that round, and he knew it.
And that was also his way of making it more difficult for the United States.
Absolutely. It made it very difficult for the United States, because how do you know who's a criminal and who isn't? I mean, some people were kind of obvious, but others were not.
Well, that must have made it difficult for you, too, because maybe you're a criminal. Who knows?
Well, I have to tell you that to this day, when I say I came in the boatlift or I'm writing a book about the boatlift, people tell me, oh, my God, that's when all the criminals came from Cuba. Or otherwise they tell me, you don't look like a Marielito, which is the word that was immediately used to describe us. And I'm always, so what does a Marielito look like? Scarface? That right. Movie did not help, I have to tell you.
I bet it didn't. Tell me about what that movie did.
Well, you know, the main character was...
this is the Al Pacino character.
Al Pacino, yeah. Which is, I mean, it was a good... I like him very much. He's a terrific actor, and it was a good role for him. But it was very damaging for us because it made us all look like we were, you know, crazy. There was also the time of the cocaine, so-called cocaine cowboys in Miami, so it wasn't far from the truth. From the truth, I just simply doubt that Marielito himself got that far in that business. But that was the idea, you know, that we were all out here because we wanted to make money and that we would do it in any way possible, including breaking the law to that gross degree, which is what the movie was about.
My guest is Mirta Ojito. Her new memoir is called Finding Mañana, a memoir of a Cuban exodus. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mirta Ojito, and her new book is called Finding Mañana, a memoir of a Cuban exodus, and it's part memoir, part history of the Mariel boatlift. She came here on the boatlift in 1980. You know, when you were describing what happened when the police knocked on your door and told you it was time to go, you mentioned that you and your mother were home, your sister was in school, your father was on his way back to work after a lunch break. So here you are ready to flee the country, but the family isn't together, and there isn't a lot of time. So I take it you were able to round up the rest of the family.
Very quickly. We were able to round up the rest of the family very quickly, and it was a terrifying moment because the one thing we had very clear was that we were not going to leave unless we were all together. At the time, the Cuban government was pretty much, and I think on purpose, breaking up families. That means that, for example, in the case of my uncle, he was only allowed to claim two people. But somebody else who was with him in the boat was also only allowed to claim two people. And one of his people didn't come, so they gave him one. In other words, he was able to cobble together a few slots so that the four of us could live together. And we knew that. We didn't know what was happening with my uncle, but we knew that not every family was able to live together or to live at all. And we had made a decision that either we left together or we did not at all. So it was a moment of panic to have to go get my father quickly and my sister before the police got tired and left. We didn't know if at some point the police was going to say, you know what, you're not here, sorry, try next time. So, but we managed to do it pretty quickly.
Would you describe the scene at the Mariel Harbor when you got there?
Yes, the first thing I remember seeing was my uncle. He was wearing a very dirty white T-shirt. I had a little bit of a beard from not shaving for about 16 or 17 days. And that was quite emotional, seeing him there finally. And then I remember, you know, the sounds of the harbor, the people running around, the guards, bullhorns. It was all very confusing. I do remember getting quickly in our boat and then seeing it fill up slowly by people I did not know and that clearly were not related to anyone on board. There were about 7 people who had left with my uncle to pick up relatives. And those people arriving or getting into our boat did not belong to anyone. And so we huddled, all of us who we knew we were related to someone in the boat, huddled in one end of the boat and sort of left everyone else on the other side. And just waiting for the time to leave. And it took a long time. And when we finally got it, the boat, which was called the Valley Chief, broke down.
And then what happened?
And then that was another moment of desperation. Then my uncle decided that he needed to find, he was the only one who spoke English in the group. And he decided that we needed to find somebody else who would take us to Miami or to Key West. And went in search of that person and found one boat captain who was eager to leave. He was not getting the people that he had come to get. And luckily for us, he said that, yes, that he would take the women and the children and that he would tow the other boat, the Valley Chief, with the men on board to international waters. And that's what he did. And in fact, that was the captain of the Mañana and is the person I set out to find in 1999 and the reason we have this book now to begin with.
Okay, so you're in this yacht, the Mañana, which is towing the broken-down Valley Chief, the boat that your uncle came in on. And then the Valley Chief is let go in international waters. And then what? Then you're separated from your father and your uncle. What happened to them?
I did not see the moment in which the Mañana let the Valley Chief go. I was very, very sick and sleeping and throwing up. It was a very horrible ordeal, 16 hours. But I remember waking up in the middle of the night. It was Mother's Day. It was Sunday. And saying, you know, Happy Mother's Day to my mother. And then I saw her face, and her eyes were very dark, like, you know, my mother has very dark eyes with like black pools. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, you know, we've let go of the Valley Chief, and I don't know where your father is.
So there was a period there when you and your mother thought you might never see your father and your uncle again.
Right. We found him again, or they found us, rather, when after we had arrived, we were taken to sort of a military warehouse, a very large place, and there were thousands of people there. And there we found my uncle's wife and my father's sister, who had come to pick us up. We left with one of them, and the other remained behind, waiting for the men, for my father and his brother. But, you know, in the rush to leave, we left our papers behind, this sort of entry papers we had received when we arrived. And we had been told not to lose the papers, but we left them behind. And therefore, on the way to Miami, we were stopped and told we needed to wait before we could proceed for our papers. And sometime that night, I was sleeping inside the car by the side of the road. And I felt this warmth. And it was my father.
How did he find you?
Because he was driving to Miami with his sister, and they recognized the car stopped in the middle of the road, the other car. And then, of course, they stopped and saw my mother and saw that my sister and I were sleeping inside the car.
So it all worked out.
It all worked out, yeah.
Do your parents have any second thoughts about having left Cuba? Does their life in Florida measure up to what their expectations were?
You can't see me, but I'm smiling. My father has never had a second thought. I remember when a neighbor of my uncle asked him, "Well, so have you adapted well?" And my father just looked at her and said, "Ma'am, I adapted before I came here." he so wanted it. It was so much his dream that he absolutely loves his country. Both he and my mother are U.S. citizens. They vote in every election. And they just, especially my father, my mother, you know, likes what happened. In other words, the end result, she likes to see me and my sister thriving, but she had to pay a very, very high price. She left her father behind. He was ill, my grandfather. And I don't think she's ever reconciled herself with that.
Did your grandfather encourage her to leave, or did he want her to stay?
He encouraged her to leave. He knew from the moment my mother married my father that he would one day lose her. And he totally identified with my father in political terms. He understood my father, and he knew it was going to happen. So I think the last time he saw us, he had a sense that it would be the last time. But I think he thought it was because he would die before. In fact, he died 6 months after we were here.
Mirta Ojito is the author of Finding Mañana, a memoir of a Cuban exodus. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel Night and Day in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Dibner Fund, encouraging the understanding of science and technology in our lives. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, the debate in the Carter administration about the Mariel boat lift. We continue our conversation with journalist Mirta Ojito. Her new memoir is about coming to the U.S. on the boat lift. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel by Kazuo Ishiguro, and Ken Tucker reviews Bruce Springsteen's new CD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mirta Ojito. Her new memoir is about coming to the U.S. in the Mariel boat lift 25 years ago, when Castro allowed Cubans to leave from the port of Mariel. Ojito was 16 when she left Havana with her parents. She's now a journalist and shared a Pulitzer Prize for her contribution to the New York Times series, How Race is Lived in America. The title of her memoir, Finding Mañana, refers to the boat, the Mañana, that took her here. While researching the book, she went looking for the boat and its captain. So you found the captain of the boat that took you from Cuba to Florida. What did you learn about him?
He's a wonderful person. He's just a wonderful person. I'm so glad he's in my life. We're now friends. He came to our house Christmas Day last year, and he's met my husband and my children, and we all love him. He's just a great guy. I told him when I met him, I could not have asked for a better hero in my life.
Why did he do it? Why did he take the yacht and let you and others on it?
Well, Mike Howell is a Vietnam veteran, and he was almost killed in Vietnam. He went to Vietnam when he was 18. He lost his left arm at 19. And he felt, he told me that he was alive for a purpose. It was like he was leaving some extra time. He should have died in Vietnam. And I don't think it's survivor's guilt. I think it's survivor's gratitude. I think because of that, he had a debt with God, even though by that point he had stopped believing in God. I think the Catholic boy in him was still there, and he felt he had this debt with God. And when several Cubans from New Orleans, he lives in New Orleans, approached him and asked him, you know, would you take this money and take us to Cuba to get our relatives? He said, I'll take you to Cuba, but I'm not going to take your money. So he took these people, whom I've met, of course, they're in the book as well. And for a variety of reasons, these people could not get their relatives out of Cuba. And then he was ready to come back and by himself, you know, without any refugees. And that's when he met my uncle. He said he took a look at the Valley Chief and realized that it was extremely, extremely dangerous. Too many people. There were more than 200, perhaps 300 people in that boat.
This was your uncle's boat?
Yeah, the one that he had chartered. And he thought, you know, if I don't do it, who would? Who's going to take these people out? And decided in what moment to do it. And he never charged anything. And the interesting thing is that he didn't know. He said that, he told me later when I found him, that when he saw us leave, he and a friend who went with him, David, looked at each other and cried. They were crying because they felt right. They felt that they had done something very important.
You know, it's
and then he never heard. Then he never heard from any of us until I showed up in his boat.
That's the thing. You know, it's amazing that after an experience like this, in which he's basically saving the lives and giving new lives to a group of people,
right?
And then there's like, you don't know where you're going. And it's not like you have necessarily a phone number to give, or you know, there's no email address to give. And it's amazing how people just kind of leave after that without exchanging any information or any way of like sending a thank you card even.
Exactly. But who would have thought of that? You know, refugees, I don't know any refugees coming off a boat who thinks of a thank you card. But that's what I did years later, in effect. Instead of sending a thank you card, I went myself. I showed up and knocked on his door. He lives in the boat, by the way. He lives in the Mañana.
Oh, well.
And just, I mean, I've gone out with him in the boat twice already, and it's been a wonderful experience. And I just said, you know, here I am, and you brought me from Cuba, and I couldn't wait to meet you. Thank you so much. And he was thrilled. He's still thrilled about it.
You did a lot of research for this book.
Yes.
And you talked to people who were in the Carter administration at the time of the mm-hmm. Mariel boat lift. And you talk mm-hmm. about some of the controversies behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. What surprises you most about what the controversies were like, what the debate was like within the Carter administration?
You know, what really surprised me was that I thought that when Carter had said that Americans should receive us with open arms and open heart, he had really meant it. It turns out he didn't. I actually sent him a message a while ago, and he replied saying that he had been misunderstood. That's not what he had meant. He had not meant to encourage a boat lift at all. What he meant to do was to say, if those who have already arrived, and at that point it wasn't that many, let's be nice to them, because after all, we're all immigrants. But he did not mean for his words to mean that the boat lift was on and that Fidel could send whoever he wanted and that it would last for 5 very long months in a re-election year. In an election year, actually. He was running for re-election. When so many other things were going on in this country, this was the beginning of 1980, they understood very early on that the only way to stop the boat lift was through the use of force. Coast Guard service told them, Mr. President, we will have to use force. And the government made a choice, a government that, remember, was guided by principles of respect for human rights all over the world, not to not only use force against unarmed refugees, but not even to intimidate us. On the contrary, to help us. The Coast Guard saved an untold number of lives, and I'm very grateful for that. But I was surprised when I learned, as a reporter, that in fact they had discussed all kinds of options to stop the boat lift, and that it simply had gone on because they were not able to come up with one that worked in time. Eventually they did, but now before hundreds of boats had already left for Cuba and came back eventually and slowly full of refugees.
And just to put this into context, this is about the same time of the Carter administration's failed rescue attempt of the American hostages in Iran.
Yes, exactly.
So there's a lot going on.
A lot going on, yes.
So what about the negotiations between the Carter administration and Castro? What surprised you most about that?
It surprised me that it was Castro who stopped the boat lift. I thought, remember, this is something that I really had not written about as a reporter because I was 16 at the time. So I lived the story, I didn't report it, and it's quite different when you are the reporter in the story. So perhaps reporters knew that back when it happened, but I didn't. It surprised me that it was Castro the one who put a stop to it, not the United States. On May 14th, 1980, the United States announced a series of measures to stop the boat lift. And to a certain extent, they stopped in the sense that after that date, very few boats left for Cuba, if any. But many, many boats had already left. So, in fact, it was up to Castro how those boats were coming back, with one refugee each, completely empty, or 200 each, which is what he did, until he basically, I think, either ran out of people that he wanted to see go or was too exhausted and embarrassed by the whole process. And by the time two people from the Carter administration went to Cuba to negotiate the end of the boat lift with him, they told me that he basically said, you know what, I have already made up my mind, and this is going to happen whether you ask me or not. In other words, he wanted to give the impression that he was not, obeying an order from the United States, but that he had already decided to stop the boat lift for his own motivations. And the motivations, I think, more than anything else, was the economic cost. The country was in a total upheaval. Everyone had lost someone to the boat lift, someone to the United States, and he needed to put a stop to that. He needed to go back to the business of running a country instead of organizing a flotilla of people who were leaving the country.
My guest is Mirta Ojito. Her new memoir is called Finding Mañana, a memoir of a Cuban exodus. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mirta Ojito. Her new memoir, Finding Mañana, is about coming to the U.S. from Cuba 25 years ago in the Mariel boat lift. Your ambition when you were young and still living in Cuba was to one day be a journalist. You thought that would never happen because you moved to a country and didn't speak the language. You learned to speak and write English. I can vouch for the fact you write it quite well. It's a beautifully written book. I'm wondering what it means to you now to be a journalist who has written about the boat lift in the new book and who has covered the Cuban community in South Florida.
You know, I've been a reporter for so long, since 1987, that can I tell you, I've never given this question some serious thought. It's just what I am. It's what I do. And I don't know that it means anything other than, well, you know what it does. Well, I'll tell you what it means. Learning English is, other than having my children, healthy children, is the biggest, single, most important accomplishment of my life, because I thought I was never, ever going to learn English. And being able to write it is just a wonderful thing. But and also if people like what I do, to me still is so humbling and incredibly amazing and wonderful to have people. Sometimes they remember a story I wrote and they call me or they see me in the supermarket or whatnot. And I just think it's great. And I'm so grateful that I had, I don't know, my love of reading, my wonderful teachers, my wonderful parents that allowed me to go to school. They worked 2 and 3 jobs so that I could continue in school. Not all immigrants have that luck, and I did. And that just made such a huge difference in my life that I have to tell you, you know, humbled and grateful.
How old are your children now?
I have 3 boys, 10, 5, and the little one is going to be 2 on Sunday.
Have any of them ever been to Cuba?
No, but we've tried. A couple of years ago, we tried. My husband and I asked for visas to go to Cuba with the oldest because we wanted him to see Cuba, but also because he's really into baseball. And I had this dream of seeing him playing baseball in the streets of Havana. And I have been told that boys there don't, you know, they have to, I don't know what they do, but they don't really have baseballs or gloves or bats. So I thought I would take this suitcase full of all these things and see my boy play baseball in the streets of Havana, as I never did because I never played baseball. And we were not allowed. He got the visa, my son, but my husband and I did not. And of course, we didn't send him. I also asked for a visa while I was reporting this book because I wanted to be able to interview some Cuban officials, and I did not get it.
How much do your children know about your family's story?
My oldest, who is 10 in 5th grade and a wonderful reader, is reading the book and relating very well to it. I was pleased to see. So he knows quite a bit of it. And the others are too little. We just went to the Books and Books, a bookstore here in Miami yesterday, in fact. And there was a poster there announcing my reading. And my 5-year-old stopped at the door and said, "What are you doing there? What is your picture doing there?" He was shocked. So he has no idea.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mirta Ojeda is the author of Finding Mañana, a memoir of a Cuban exodus. Ever since the publication of his third novel, The Remains of the Day, which won the Booker Prize and was adapted into an award-winning film, Kazuo Ishiguro has been recognized as one of England's most compelling contemporary writers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of his new novel, Never Let Me Go.
I live with someone who demands near-instant reviews of any book he's seen me pick up. How is it, this connubial book gnat will ask, buzzing around my reading chair? Sometimes it's easy enough to shake my head, yes, no, and he's appeased. But with other books, such as Kazuo Ishiguro's novels, I have to swat away this pesky plea for a quick evaluation. As Ishiguro superbly demonstrated in his mega bestseller, The Remains of the Day, and less successfully in his recent book, When We Were Orphans, he's a novelist who has a fondness for last-minute revelations and sometimes even changes in genre that disrupt a reader's sense of connection with his fictional worlds. True to shape-shifting form, Ishiguro's latest novel, Never Let Me Go, is a restless creation, referencing the tradition of British school days fiction and sci-fi novels, and even treading lightly into the realm of the mystery. Such a protean novel takes time to settle in a reader's mind. How is it, the connubial book gnat keeps asking? The only sure thing I can say is, worth reading. Never Let Me Go is a haunting allegory about our own helplessness to stop time and hold fast to the ones we love. Ishiguro's genius is to grab hold of the free-floating tragedy of the human condition through the most mundane images and snatches of conversation. I'm still mulling over the novel's weaknesses, the gimmicky cliffhangers, the pallid feel of so many of the characters. But I'm also certain that there are scenes in this novel that are so powerful, they will indeed never let me go. The one constant in Ishiguro's work is its overwhelming mood of melancholy. His narrators always look backward in regret, and our narrator here, known only by her nickname of Kath, is no exception. The present time of the novel is the late 1990s, and Kath, who introduces herself as a 31-year-old woman, launches into a reminiscence about her childhood and adolescence at an English boarding school. Right away, something feels off here. Kath never mentions her parents. Instead, she talks about adults called guardians and focuses on her two best friends, the manipulative Ruth and the cranky but endearing Tommy. Throughout part one of the novel, Ishiguro brilliantly recreates the long process by which a child comes to an awareness of herself and her world. "It's hard now to remember just how much we knew by then," Kath says in a typical aside about her 8-year-old self and her friends. "If we were keen to avoid certain topics, it was probably more because they embarrassed us." It sounds here as though Kath is talking about sex, but she's not. The kicker in this novel, and the astute reader catches on fairly early, so I'm not giving much away, is that Kath and her friends are clones. They're being raised in boarding schools and institutions across Great Britain for the purpose of giving body parts, donations, as the Orwell speak of this novel calls them, to sick, normal human beings. Don't fear. Never Let Me Go is no more Ishiguro's attempt at writing an anti-cloning polemic than Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was. In fact, like Frankenstein, Never Let Me Go uses the fantasy of artificially constructed beings to go after big metaphysical mysteries about life, death, and the measured benevolence of an all-powerful creator. Ishiguro's characters always tend to be somewhat flat, whether that's his trademark strategy or his trademark limitation as a novelist is still for me a verdict that's up for grabs. The clones may be even flatter than his other characters because they're clones. When they come to a consciousness of their identities, they don't rage against their condition, as the monster does in Frankenstein. They question it politely. The climax of this novel, where Kath and Tommy work up their courage to confront their guardians and submit proof that even as clones, they too have souls, is heartbreaking in its doomed deference. I want more from Never Let Me Go. I especially want it to delve more deeply into the classic Ishiguro situation where characters are pushed up against the limits of their environment and perversely rationalize and adapt to them. And yet, I wouldn't want more from this novel were it not for the chill beauty and emotional resonance of what's already there. How is Never Let Me Go? Frustrating, somewhat unfinished, unforgettable.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Bruce Springsteen's new CD, Devils and Dust. This is Fresh Air. Bruce Springsteen's new album, Devils and Dust, was released today. It's a mostly solo affair, recorded without his E Street Band. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I got my finger on the trigger, but I don't know who to trust. When I look into your eyes, there's just devils and dust. We're a long, long way from home.
Time and the times we live in hang heavily over Devils and Dust. The often weary-sounding 55-year-old man on this brooding album shares none of the qualities found in the title of his most exuberant early record. He's not wild. He's certainly not innocent. And the only time he does the E Street Shuffle anymore in public is when a stadium full of revelers inspires him to shake off the ruminativeness that is now his primary creative mode. Sometimes on this collection consisting of a dozen new songs plus a DVD showing him performing five of them, it's all he can do to tap his booted toe in time to the couple of chords that he's scratching out on the acoustic guitar that dominates most of the record.
On barbed wire, highway 40 days and nights. I ain't complaining, it's my job and it suits me right. Got a sweet soul fever rushing round my head. I'm gonna sleep tonight in Maria's bed. On a dead man's suit and smiling skull ring, lucky graveyard boots and a song to sing. I keep my heart in my work, my troubles in my head, and I keep my soul in Maria's bed. Hey.
Devils in Dust, produced, as was The Rising, by Brendan O'Brien, is frequently underpinned by soft female backing vocals, a few orchestral strings, and a rhythm section, O'Brien on bass, Steve Jordan on drums. But its best new songs break new ground for Springsteen. On such songs as Maria's Bed and All I'm Thinking About, he tries out with great success a different vocal register. A daringly sinuous falsetto that gives tremendous urgency to the pleasures of the flesh. Quote, I keep my heart in my work, my troubles in my head, and I keep my soul in Maria's bed, he trills, exulting in Southern country soul. On the other song, he uses that voice to embody a kid putting away childish things to become happily addled by a girl with, quote, sweet brown legs. The increasingly intense repetition of the phrase, all I'm thinking about is you, babe, is a metaphor for a quivering horniness that's both sly and bold.
Blind man waving by the side of the road, in a flatbed Ford carrying a heavy load, sweet things sipping on a blueberry wine, on a flat black highway down in Carolina, blackbirds slipping.
Even in his gulping, yowling, Bob Dylan drunk youth, Springsteen never crammed as many words into a song as he does on one here, Black Cowboys. Its rushed lines burst with the details of how a kid finds his frail sense of innocence and comfort steadily destroyed by a succession of small betrayals from the adult world. Springsteen barely takes the time to nail down an end rhyme before, as Chuck Berry would say, motivating onto the next verse, scattering in his path strikingly precise images such as, quote, a smile that was fixed in a face that was never off guard. This same notion, that youthful hope and ardor too often gets wiped away by the meanness of the world, is what makes another song here, Long Time Comin', one of the most languidly beautiful Springsteen has ever recorded.
Out where the creek turns shallow and sandy, and the moon comes skimming away the stars. When mesquite comes rushing over the hilltops, straight into my arms, straight into my arms. I'm riding hard, caring to catch a rose, a fresh map that I made. Tonight I'm gonna get birth naked and bury my old soul and dance on the street and dance.
Springsteen frequently assumes different identities here. A bare-knuckled boxer in The Hitter, a morose schmo visiting a hooker in Reno. The latter actually earned Springsteen his first adult content warning advisory, which should not distract you from the fact that the song also contains some vivid writing. The DVD side of Devils in Dust finds Springsteen alone in a dark room, his singing, strumming, and puffing on a harmonica interspersed with remarks about how the new tunes are, quote, all songs about souls that are in danger or at risk through what the world is bringing to them. In other words, this could be heard as, among other things, his Bush Second Administration album. It's Springsteen's gift to acknowledge the harrowing burdens one bears in this increasingly hemmed-in, dangerous world. And he shakes off the pressure and exhaustion of that weight by illuminating the few moments of dignity and power that his characters pull out of their souls. That's what gives Devils in Dirt its drama, its complication, its kick.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Yeah, I know what it's like to fail, baby, with the whole world looking on. I know what it's like to soar and come crashing like a drunk on the bottom floor. Now you got no reason to trust me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning, Nick Anderson of the Louisville Courier-Journal. And Dr. Trip Buckenmeyer talks about treating the pain of soldiers wounded in Iraq. He's chief of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Initiative at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Join us for the next Fresh Air.